issues, Vermont voices. Equal time with Anthony Kalia and you.
You poisoned my sweet water. You cut down my green trees. The food you fed my children was the cause of that disease. My world is slowly falling down, and the air's not good to breathe. And those of us who care enough, we have to do something. What you gonna do about me?
Hello, and welcome to Equal Time Radio. I am Amy Schollenberger, and I'm hosting the show today. Before we get started today, I'd like to remind everyone to go out and vote in the Vermont state primary. Voting day is tomorrow, but you can vote today at your town clerk's office. If you wait until tomorrow, you can go to your local polling place all day, all over Vermont. It's important. Every vote's going to count in this one. Everybody's predicting low turnout, and there are some races out there, so make a plan and get it done. The Vermont American Civil Liberties Union, as well as disability rights groups, including the Green Mountain Self-Advocates, lobbied lawmakers this year to make sure tasers are not overused and that police understand how to deal with people who have mental illnesses or other types of disabilities. Today we'll be talking with Rhonda Taylor, Robert Appel, and Alan Gilbert about the court case that is happening, as well as policy developments. First, though, we'll have a quick check-in with Green Mountain Self-Advocates about their Ally of the Year award winner. You can join the conversation by calling 244-1777 or 1-877-291-8255. So first, we're going to talk to some Green Mountain Self-Advocates, Randy Lazotte and Max Barrows. Randy, are you on the phone?
I am.
Did I say your last name right, Randy?
Yes, you did.
Great. So tell us who you are and what you do there at Green Mountain Self-Advocates.
Well, like you said, my name is Randy Lazotte, and I am the president of Green Mountain Self-Advocates. We have a board with everything from a president to a treasurer and a secretary. Green Mountain Self-Advocates is a statewide organization that is run by people with disabilities, and we do a lot of stuff. We do trainings for people with disabilities. We do leadership trainings. We educate. We educate the public, and
I know one of the things.
Yearly conferences.
I know one of the things you do is you give an award out every year, and you're going to tell us a little bit about this year's award.
Yes, we give out an award every year called the Ally of the Year Award, and that's given to a person without a disability. They're called allies. And it's given to somebody who's kind of gone above and beyond their role as an ally. And we decided to give it to Anthony Polina this year.
Great. And Max, do you want to tell us a little bit about why you all picked Anthony?
The reason why we picked Anthony Polina is because he's been a real champion in making sure our voices are heard in the legislature when it comes to issues such as budget cuts and stuff like that. But also, I would say the main thing that he was really a champion on was getting the Respectful Language Bill passed earlier this year, which is something that Green Mountain Self-Advocates has been really involved in for the last 4 years. And, you know, it just without his, like, support and what he's done to make sure that, you know, the bill was passed and to really kind of include our organization in the work that was done in, the bill being passed, I think that we really felt like it was like a big example of how he has just been really there for Green Mountain Tough Advocates and really, you know, taking us seriously. And, you know, and just it was one of those examples of how, you know we were just listened to by him. So we really, we really felt like he deserved the Ally of the Year Award for just that and all the other work he has done to really be, you know, a great ally of ours.
And Max, can you just say what the Respectful Language Bill did?
The Respectful Language Bill was a bill that changed discriminatory language in the state law. Green Mountain Tough Advocates, along with other partner organizations, teamed together, and it was a lot of work, but it was worth the work. And we looked into 29 of 33 state laws, and we found a lot of language that we found that was demeaning and discriminatory toward persons with disabilities and also people that have mental health challenges. And we felt like this is a way for us to really kind of come together and say, well, one of our goals was really to, you know, tackle the usage of disrespectful language in our culture and in society. And one way of doing it was looking into the state law in Vermont and any kind of demeaning language that describes persons with disabilities to be changed. It was kind of a follow-up to other states doing similar projects or the same projects on Respectful Language Bill. And we took the idea from that as well. And really, our goal out of it was, you know, it's not just about changing laws and, you know, changing wording in state laws, but really the main goal out of this was really, you know, dignity and respect to persons with disabilities. And this was one example of, you know, kind of getting the word out that, you know, people with disabilities deserve to be, you know, respected on the same level as everyone else. And I think this was one way of doing it.
I remember seeing people carrying around binders with that bill because there were so many places in the Vermont statutes that needed to be changed. And like you said, I think it was a really big project to go through those statutes and find all the places where there was disrespectful language. And I think it was an educational moment for a lot of people in Vermont to see that.
Definitely.
Randy, do you want to say anything else about Anthony Polina's work as an ally?
Well, I would like to say, kind of piggyback off of what Max said a little bit about, there were some words in that bill that if you heard them just from somebody without a disability, you might not even think twice about it, like cute or special. Sometimes the context that you use the word in can be very disrespectful to some people.
Yeah, it's important to think about the context as well as the words. Anything else either one of you want to say before we check out?
No, I think I'm good. How about you, Max?
I really have, like, nothing else to say other than I just, you know, I'm honored to know, you know, Anthony Polina, and again, just thanking him for all the work that he has done with us. And also, I'm just honored to do the work that I do because I care about people's lives, and this is an example of how I make a difference in people's lives every day.
Well, Max Barrows and Randy Lazat, thanks for the work that you do, and thanks to all of the Green Mountain Self-Advocates. If listeners want to check out that organization and find out a little bit more about that work, you can go to gmsavt.org. Thank you, Randy and Max.
Welcome.
Oh, thank you very much. It's an honor to be on here.
So, today, as I said, we're going to be talking about tasers in Vermont and some of the things that have happened with tasers, and also a bill that was passed in this past legislative session. Our first guest today is Rhonda Taylor. Rhonda is the mother of Makata Mason, who was killed by a police taser in 2012. Rhonda, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
So, Rhonda, tell us a little bit about who you are, in addition to being Makata Mason's mother. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I have another son as well, and I have eight grandchildren, and I'm a registered nurse. I've been a nurse for going on 22 years and love nursing. I had trouble for a while after we lost Lee working in my field, but I'm back there, and I work in critical care and love the challenges. I like taking care of people. And I'm married, and we've settled up in Lancaster, New Hampshire. We have a nice view of the Connecticut River and can look over into Vermont, and that makes me feel close to Lee. McAdam, we always called him Lee. That was his middle name.
So, you know, this is a hard thing to ask you to do, but can you tell us a little bit of your story and Lee's story?
My son moved to Vermont before he was 30, and he loved it there. He was an artist and a self-taught musician. He loved to play the guitar, and he wrote some music, and he would play the guitar and sing for us whenever we would listen to him. He painted. He used a lot of different mediums with his painting. He did, in 2012, he was doing a lot of watercolors and some modern art. He was looking at being juried, and he was that gave him a lot of satisfaction, his painting and his music. He has a daughter and a son. His son lives in Maine, and his daughter lives in Vermont, and he loves them dearly. I talked to him the Friday before he was killed. He called me, and it was a blessing because we talked, and we planned a cookout in July, and the whole family was going to be there, and he was really excited about it. And we hung up, and before I got home, I had worked that night, and before I got home, I don't know why, but I called him back, and he answered, and I said, Lee, and he said, what? And I said, did I ever tell you how very much I love you? And he laughed, and he said, I love you too. And those are the last words we said to each other. So sometimes you get gifts along the way.
Yeah, I'm so glad you had that chance to say that to him. And I'm so sorry
Thank
for
you.
Your loss as well.
Thank you. We've tried over the last couple of years, have tried to funnel it into something positive from this. If you could ever find anything positive, and it was working on the taser bill. I was very fortunate to work with so many wonderful people that were part of the House and the Senate that took this bill before the government to pass it. And I worked with Robert Appel and Alan Gilbert and so many different group advocates, and it meant an awfully lot to me for that bill to pass. And it was really difficult at first going and speaking in front of groups, but I met a lot of wonderful people in Vermont, and we were able to be at the signing when Governor Shumlin signed the bill into law. And I just, all I can do is pray that it makes a difference. I think it will. I think there'll be more training, and I think they'll try to de-escalate situations so that somebody else's child isn't killed.
So we're going to talk a little bit later in the show about what exactly the bill does, but you talked a little bit about the work that you did in the State House and how important that was to you. Tell me a little bit about why you felt so compelled to do that work, even though you were dealing with your own loss and your own emotions, to go and do that work and push yourself to speak in front of people. Tell me a little bit more about what that was like.
Well, it was the only thing I felt that I could do. I couldn't bring him back, no matter how much I tried, and so it helped me to go and talk to other people that cared so much and wished that this hadn't happened and was looking for ways for it to never happen again. And it helped me a lot having that support. In fact, I wondered what we would do after the 2 years after the bill was signed. You know, where would I go from there? Because I wouldn't have this bill to focus on. And I haven't found that yet. I would like to do some volunteering, and but I haven't found any place yet.
Well, that's good to know. Some of our listeners may be looking for a volunteer out there, and they can get in touch with you.
Definitely. Thank you.
So I know some listeners probably have attended bill signings, but it's kind of an unusual thing for someone to be able to attend that. Will you just tell us what that was like, what happened, and how did you feel when the governor signed the bill?
One of the most difficult things for me, I didn't attend any of the House sessions, but I went to the Senate sessions. I spoke once, and what was difficult about being in that room was there was quite a mixture. The group was very mixed. There were a lot of law enforcement, and they were dressed with their tools, their guns, and their tasers, and listening to, you know, everybody has a side, and everybody tried to meet in the middle, and it was difficult listening to the other side, even though I do understand some of that. Every situation is different, and so that was difficult. I learned more about politics than I've ever known in my entire life. I was able to send emails and letters to the different senators. I've never done anything like that before, and to have them respond to me too, with such regard, and just to see it follow through and be able to go to the governor's room and have him sign the bill meant a lot, and there were a lot of reporters there that captured this. My son had a little dog named Bear, and if anybody had seen my son on the internet and in the papers, he was always pictured holding his little dog Bear. I was given Bear by Lee's girlfriend about 6 months after he died, and he's probably what helped to save me, because I have him, and he's a wonderful little dog, and he's very comforting. And we were able to take him to the signing, and he had a little T-shirt on, and said about the bill, and he was in the news, and our whole family was there, my husband and my son Trey and his wife Jess, and it was a very special day for us.
Well, Rhonda, thank you so much for the work that you did to get that bill passed, and I think it's a really nice legacy that you leave for Lee, even though it would have been much better if you hadn't had to lose him that way. I think that you're really doing him an honor by doing this work, and I wish you well in finding the next thing that you work on.
Thank you very much, Amy, and thank you for inviting me to your show.
Sure, thank you. So next we're going to talk to Robert Appel. Robert's a lawyer, and he has worked for many years on human and civil rights issues, and he's working on a court case that has to do with Lee Mason. Robert, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Amy. How you doing?
Good.
Good. Thanks for including me on this discussion.
I'm really glad to have you, Robert.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit more than what I just said about yourself and how you're involved in the McAdam-Mason case.
Okay. Well, until the end of 2012, I had a 35-year career with the state of Vermont in a variety of positions. My last almost 12 was as the director of the Human Rights Commission. Prior to that, I was defender general overseeing the public defender system. So in my 35 years, I've worked both as an investigator and a lawyer, both in civil rights enforcement and in criminal defense. So very familiar with these issues. My sort of niche has been dealing with or helping people with disabilities, particularly psychiatric disabilities. So I'm very happy to be working with Rhonda on this case. I think it's a very important case. And before I get into the case too much, I have to really take my hat off to Rhonda and to Max and Green Mountain Self-Advocates and all others who came out and convinced our legislators that we needed some regulation of these, they're now called less lethal devices made by Taser International. It used to be called less than lethal, but Taser seems to keep losing people through the use of their products. So without that sort of citizen involvement, Amy, as you well know, the State House is an accessible place, and when legislators hear from regular folks, not just us who they see all the time, it really does have an impact. And Rhonda and her husband, Kenny, did a remarkable job hanging in there in very difficult times, and their perseverance paid off in this bill that I think will make a difference. There's still much, much, much more work to be done, but it's an important step.
I'm glad that you recognize that work. I think that, you know, having to suffer a tragedy like that and then turning it around into doing this kind of work and really advocating for other people who, so they don't have to go through the same kind of tragedy, it is really worth recognizing. And I know that the Green Mountain Self-Advocates and other groups were also very involved in that
right.
bill.
Well,
and
Alan, who you have on in a little bit, Alan Gilbert was exemplary in his would call it bird dogging the bill and making sure it came out in a worthwhile form. Disability Rights Vermont, A.J. Rubin and Ed Paquin are also very active. You know, sort of a cadre of disability rights advocates, and all of us were engaged on this bill.
So before we get into the bill, because Alan, I think, is going yep. to give us the details about that, tell us about this court case. What is the issue and what's going on with the case right now?
Well, we're alleging that the state police used excessive force in taking Mr. Mason into custody, which is essentially what they did. Unfortunately, their means of taking him into custody ended up fatal to Mr. Mason. I mean, we certainly recognize the challenges inherent in police work, and in Vermont, it seems, you know, in other places, including Ferguson, Missouri, ironically, on the day of the funeral of Michael Brown, police often engage in violent confrontations with people of color. Since there's fewer people of color here, it seems like the violent confrontations take place with people with psychiatric disabilities or learning disabilities. And I thought Green Mountain Self-Advocates' presence in terms of helping legislators understand and slowly but surely police understand that certain people don't react the same way. I mean, people with autism are not going to respond to a verbal command the way you and I might, or somebody in a full-blown psychotic situation, which we believe McAdam Lee Mason was on the day in question, tend to provoke an over-response, in my view, by police. Police are not, their orientation is to control and end the situation, not to work with person with the disability, work through it and try to de-escalate. There are steps being taken in that area, but in this case, we don't believe that they were deployed. The officer who ended up tasing him had been on the scene a matter of minutes. He was the only officer to have pointed a weapon. He pointed a rifle at Mr. Mason, told him to get on the ground. Lee did so. He had no weapon. He had nothing in his hands whatsoever. According to the state police investigation, which is primarily what I used in forming the complaint, apparently Mr. Mason got up and stood up and started walking to the officer, and the officer tased him. The officers on the scene were on the scene because Mr. Mason did have a psychiatric history. He had worked with both the Clara Martin Center and Dartmouth-Hitchcock. He's in Thetford, that's sort of the local major hospital. He'd called Claire Martin that morning and saying he was having a hard time, had suicidal thoughts. That was he was told to call the emergency department at Dartmouth-Hitchcock. He did. He made statements that he was, in fact, feeling like he wanted to hurt himself. That was reported to the police as being he was suicidal and homicidal, and that there were weapons involved. There were weapons in the house, which his partner, Teresa David Donis, was real clear in the state police, in telling the police there were no weapons on the premises. Nonetheless, the police came in numbers. There were four or five officers on the scene. There were a number of officers within 25 feet of Mr. Mason when Trooper Schaefer discharged his taser. his paramour, Teresa David Donis, had told the police. She went to the house, said he had been in a, had had a seizure the night before. He suffered from a form of seizure disorder. Taser manufacturers say do not deploy this device on people with seizure disorders. Taser also says do not deploy the weapon in the chest near the heart. Nonetheless, and the trooper involved had just completed Taser recertification in March of 2012. Mr. Mason was shot and died on June 20th. The officer involved had not completed the mental health training that we and I and others have been encouraging state police to make mandatory, all police to make mandatory. So what happened was the officer shot him. The barbs went in his chest. His eyes rolled back in his head. And he immediately started turning blue. He really never came back to responsiveness. He did survive a few hours, but died at the hospital in Dartmouth. The medical examiner of New Hampshire performed the autopsy because the death was pronounced in New Hampshire. Apparently, Taser International lobbied very hard for the cause of death to be what they've titled excited delirium, which is like an overreaction to intoxicants, street drugs, etc. The final autopsy reports termed the manner of death a homicide by the use of an electronic control device shot by the police officer. So, in our view, although there was a proper caretaking function in making sure that Mr. Mason didn't hurt himself or others, the degree to which force was applied in this particular circumstance violated the Constitution's prohibition against unreasonable search and seizure. He should not have been seized with an electronic control device with the knowledge that the officers had, which directly resulted in his death.
Robert, thanks for telling that story. We have to take a quick break, but stay with us because sure. I have a few more questions for you.
Always On Time Signs and Designs can help put your business image before the public with cost-efficient signs, banners, vehicle lettering, and even full vehicle wraps. They work with your budget, and like their name says, they deliver on time every time. Let's hear from Tom Beardsley, Vice President of Sales at the Radio Vermont Group.
Here at the Radio Vermont Group, when we need banners, oftentimes we need them right away. So I call the guys at Always On Time Signs and Designs and tell them what I'm looking for. The turnaround is quick, the prices are right, the quality is outstanding. So I wouldn't hesitate to recommend to anyone, if you need banners, signage of any kind for any event, for promoting your business or whatever, give them a call. Always On Time Signs and Designs. They really are great. We've had a great experience with them.
Call Always On Time Signs and Designs at 223-8948 or 1-800-547-0808 for a free client consultation. Located at 115 Industrial Lane in Berlin. Always On Time Signs and Designs. 223-8948 or 1-800-547-0808.
WDEV is your home for Boston Red Sox baseball all season long. Coverage is brought to you in part by Cody Chevrolet on the Barrie Montpelier Road, Lenny Shoe and Apparel in Barrie, Williston, St. Albans, and Plattsburgh.
Stop by, second by Pedroia, gets up, throws, and got on at first base. What a play by Petey.
Mad River Garden Center, Route 100, Waitsfield. Harvest Equipment in Newport, Swanton, and Williston. Your co-op insurance agents across Vermont and online at coopinsurance.com. 802 Honda, exit 7, I-89 in Berlin. 802 Toyota and Twin City Subaru on the Berlin Mall Road.
And he swings and drives one deep to right. This one is long gone. Three-run homer. The Red Sox lead it 4-1.
Your home for Boston Red Sox baseball is WDEV, FM, and AM.
Hello and welcome back to Equal Time Radio. We're talking about tasers in Vermont, and we have Robert Appel on the line. He's a lawyer in the case for McAdam Mason, who was killed by a police taser in 2012. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can dial 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Robert, you just told us the story of what happened with Lee Mason on the day that he was killed, and that was almost over 2 years ago now.
Correct.
So how long does a case like this take, and where are you in the process?
Well, we filed in federal court in mid-June. We were running up against the statute of limitations on wrongful death. There's some other claims beyond the unconstitutional use of force claims. This case was somewhat complicated because Mr. Mason died without a will, and Rhonda was appointed to be the administrator of his estate. The estate is the entity that brings the claim. There was a contest in the probate court between Ms. Taylor and the daughter of, and the mother of Mr. Mason's minor daughter, which is still not totally resolved, but we wanted to file within that two-year statute of limitations. Federal court moves along more quickly than state court. The state has already filed a motion to dismiss, which we need to respond to within the next couple of weeks. I would expect the case to move forward towards trial within the next 12 months.
And how long does a trial take? What kind of process is that?
Well, it's very similar to state court. My sense is that, you know, there would be expert witnesses on both sides, fact witnesses, people who were on the scene. We're probably talking most of a week to actually try the case.
And is there anything that people can do to support the family and Rhonda Taylor while this case is moving forward?
I think, you know, I'm a believer in pairing political action with legal work. And I do want to spend a moment or two talking about Montpelier's experience with tasers. And I don't know if you or your listeners are aware of it, but the police chief, Tony Fakos, in Montpelier, like most chiefs, was a large proponent of tasers. Chiefs like these devices because they say it cuts down on injuries to officers and workers' comp claims. There was a large public debate in the city of Montpelier. A special committee was appointed to discuss whether or not the city of Montpelier wanted to purchase tasers. And in the end, and there's an excellent report that was written by its chair, a fellow named Jeffrey Dworkin, who was a criminal defense attorney and now is a psychologist. It's available on the city of Montpelier's website. I believe it's still up on ACLU's website. It's really a great way to educate yourself on taser use. I'm a firm believer that police should be fully accountable to the public. In fact, the Vermont Constitution in Chapter 1 says that all internal police officers are directly accountable to the citizenry. So every department has some degree of citizen oversight, not to the degree that I think it should be, but, you know, chiefs are appointed by city councils, councils are elected. People can engage in a public dialogue about whether we want to equip our officers with this device that essentially, I don't know if anyone's described its effect, but it's 50,000 volts of electricity in up to a five-second burst. That's with the barbs. There's a direct application which can be even longer. It basically causes the subject to lose control of all bodily functions, usually results in a face plant, meaning the person collapses face first, and taser has been more and more restrictive of how to use it, where to use it. It's basically becoming, I mean, taser is very concerned about its own liability, and they're really shifting by their manufacturer's warnings, more and more liability onto police departments, which ultimately is on the citizenry. I mean, these claims are covered by insurance, but the rates go up. I mean, it's really a cost to the taxpayer. So the question then becomes, is there a better way for police to interact with people in psychiatric crises? And I know there are better ways, and involving social workers to go out on the scene. There's been some steps in that direction in Vermont, albeit late. I've heard the complaint it can't be done in Vermont. We're too rural. Maine's been doing it for years and years and years. But we need to move more in that direction because police orientation is to control and clear. They're not really, by and large, trained to de-escalate and engage in talk with someone who is in crisis. So, it seems, I'm a big one on adages, and unfortunately, police are a hammer, and to hammers, everything looks like a nail. So, you know, I think we need to broaden our range of responses to people who our brothers and sisters who have struggles with their mental status.
A little bit of compassion goes a long way, maybe.
Yep, absolutely. And, you know, and officers, there's some who are very good at it and some who are not very good at it. And, you know, in some departments, officers are recruited and trained specifically to do this work. And, you know, it can be done here. It's a question of will, commitment, and a little bit of money.
Robert, before I let you go, I want to just follow a thread that you just mentioned but didn't really go into. So tasers are called tasers because there's a company called Taser that makes these gun-like
mechanisms. Yeah, Taser's an acronym. And ask Alan what it is. It's like Thomas something... hell no. It's an acronym.
So anyway, my point is that there's a company, a corporation that makes these devices and sells them to police forces as a quote-unquote alternative to using a gun.
Right.
And what you just said is that the liability is shifting from the company to the police force and thus, you know, by default to the taxpayers who pay for the police force.
Absolutely.
Can you just lay that out a little bit more clearly?
Sure. I mean, if you're going to go after a manufacturer, a corporation, you're normally going to look at some sort of products liability theory. So the way to avoid liability for a dangerous product is to warn against its use in a variety of situations. So Taser has gotten pretty sophisticated in adding warning after warning after warning to limit its authorized use to, in my view, next to nil. So then if a department is equipped with these devices, officers see that as a less than lethal, but now Taser calls it less lethal because there's been so many deaths. Rhonda testified before Senate Gov Ops of something like 700 Taser deaths in America, let alone around the world. So Taser is applying more and more. Don't shoot somebody in the chest. You're supposed to shoot them in the back or the buttocks. Don't shoot somebody at a height. Don't shoot somebody running. Don't shoot somebody who's acutely intoxicated. Don't shoot somebody with a seizure disorder. So, you know, if an officer reacts, and they're trained to react, I mean, that's how they're trained, is to react to situations, and uses a Taser where the manufacturer has said, oh, you shouldn't have done that, like the seizure disorder here, you know, we really can't go after Taser on this because they warned against the use the state police deployed against McAdam Mason on June 20th. So the liability shifts from the manufacturer to the police department, which is a public entity, which ultimately we as taxpayers must shoulder.
Thanks for explaining that. I think it's really important for people to understand that it's not necessarily the police, you know, the police officer is doing what he's trained to do, he or she is trained to do.
Yes.
And they're reacting in situations that are sometimes, you know, second by second things are happening.
Absolutely. They're inherently stressful, and you resort to the sort of muscle training that you get at the academy.
And essentially, the corporation is getting away with saying, well, too bad, it's that guy's fault because we told him not to do that.
Absolutely.
So I think that's a really important point. I also just have to comment on the irony of a phrase like less lethal. I mean, you're either dead or you're not dead. You can't be less dead. I think that's another way that they're sort of pushing off the consequences of this kind of a tool.
Well, this whole notion of excited delirium is another strategy by Taser, which is sort of a creation of a new mental health diagnosis heretofore unknown. And they have a researcher out of the University of Miami who goes around proselytizing this excited delirium theory.
Wow.
Not widely held.
Well, you've given us a lot to think about, Robert. I hate to let you go, but
I'm happy to.
I want to make sure Alan,
share the time with Alan. He's very knowledgeable about these issues, and I look forward to hearing the rest of the program.
So, thank you so much for joining us, Robert.
Yeah, thank
Appel.
You.
Bye now. So, listeners, again, if you want to join us, it's 244-1777 or 877-291-8255, and we're talking about the use of tasers in the state of Vermont. Alan Gilbert, are you with us?
I am.
So, Alan, you're in charge of the American Civil Liberties Union in Vermont, and you have a resume pages long. You want to give us a couple highlights?
No, I sent you the short version. I used to be a news reporter, worked for the Rutland Herald and the Times Argus. I was a teacher for a while, including a stint at a German university, and I was a principal in a research company, a public policy research company that some other former journalists and I set up to do writing and editing and, in the end, web work for mainly nonprofits around Vermont. I was involved with the ACLU through the Brigham lawsuit starting in 1995, and when the job of executive director came up in 2003, I applied, and I've been here since the beginning of 2004.
So tell us a little bit about what the Vermont ACLU does.
The American Civil Liberties Union has a very straightforward focus. The focus is to make sure that the rights guaranteed in the U.S. and the Vermont constitutions are protected, and to make sure that when people exercise those rights, they're not punished for doing so. That's our mission.
Short and sweet, right?
It's very focused, and it sounds easy, but you have to remember there are not only 10 amendments in the Bill of Rights, there are other amendments in the U.S. Constitution that guarantee things like equal protection and the right to vote and so on. So we deal with a very broad area of issues. It's not simply free speech. It's not simply your freedom to be free of excessive force from police officers. It's any of a number of things. So things get pretty complex pretty quickly.
Well, it's good to have folks watching out for those things. Robert Appel just called you a bird dog. He said you were bird dogging the bill as it went through, and I think that's an apt description. I've certainly seen you in that pose in the State House, paying close attention and making sure things are going well. If listeners want to check out the ACLU of Vermont, the website is acluvt.org. So, Alan, this past year we've mentioned this bill a few times, but we haven't really talked about it yet. So the bill was H-225. Now it's Act 180. It was signed into law in June. Tell us what this bill does.
Okay, and really quick bullet point kind of listing. There's a requirement that there has to be a statewide policy on the use and the training around tasers. There's a new deployment standard when police officers can use a taser. The bill stresses de-escalation before using a taser. See if de-escalation techniques work instead. There's a clear definition of the vulnerable groups, or special populations as it's called, who face additional risks from tasers. There's going to be annual reporting on taser use incidents. There's a request for a study by the Law Enforcement Advisory Board of the use of cameras, body cameras, by officers authorized to carry tasers. And there's also a study and policy requested of the Law Enforcement Advisory Board on the calibration and testing of electronic control devices. And finally, there's one thing that sometimes gets overlooked, but Robert mentioned in his remarks. There's another section of the bill that says that Vermont officers must follow the manufacturer's recommendations when using one of these weapons. And that's a pretty important element of all this, because as Robert was noting, Taser, the manufacturer of the most common conducted energy weapon, has set any of a number of recommendations for when a taser should not be used. And if officers don't follow those recommendations, they could be liable.
So, not to put you on the spot, but Robert said you might know what the TASER acronym stands for.
Oh, yeah. TASER stands for Thomas A. Swift Electric Rifle. And for people whose, I don't know, fathers or grandfathers or maybe great-grandfathers at this point, were boys back in the early 1900s, there was a whole series of books called Thomas A. Swift, Boy Detective. And Tom Swift, in one of those books, actually invented an electric rifle that I believe he used to shoot elephants on an African safari. But the Taser folks, who actually did not start out in their company to build a gun. They started out to build a device to protect cars from being stolen. They ended up with a gun, and one of them had been a fan of Thomas A. Swift boy detective novels, and so they came up with the acronym TASER.
Wow, I'm so glad I asked you that question.
Yeah, not too many people know that. It's one of those odd things.
So where are we in the process right now? You said one of the things the bill calls for is a statewide policy on training and use. I suspect that there's a process for getting that policy in place. And how does that work, and how can people be involved in it?
Well, it's actually pretty far along. process is being overseen by the state's Criminal Justice Training Council, which actually had begun working on a policy a bit more than a year ago, and it was the rejection of that policy, at least by many of us advocates, that led to further examination and finally legislative action. The legislature laid out a number of things it wants to see in the policy, and the Training Council is now reworking the policy it had to make sure that it squares up with what the legislature said it had to contain at a minimum. I've seen, one draft, saw a second draft at a meeting earlier this month, and I believe there are a few more things that have to be changed in the policy, and then it's going to be good to go, supposedly. The law calls for the policy to be in place by January 1st of 2015, and all departments have to have had it adopted within the year. If they don't adopt it within the year after January 1st, 2016, it will be assumed they adopted the model policy developed by the Vermont Criminal Justice Training Council.
So if people wanted to see that, is it public yet, or will it be public?
I think it is up on the Vermont Criminal Justice Training Council website. So if somebody were to Google Vermont Criminal Justice Training Council TASER policy, I think they'd get to it.
And is there any way to make comments on it, or is that just they basically just adopt it?
I've been going to the meetings. The meetings are public. Not too many people in the public show up. They probably don't even know what the Vermont Criminal Justice Training Council is, but it actually plays a pretty important function. I'm sure that written comments would still be welcome and accepted. The person who's the head of the council is Richard Gauthier, who also is the head of the Vermont Police Academy. And I believe on the Training Council website, there is a contact button that people could get the email address to send in comments if they'd like.
Great, thank you. So another thing you mentioned about the bill is that it requires annual reporting, and I seem to recall talking to you at one point during the process and you saying it was difficult to even find out how many times tasers have been used. Is that an accurate memory that I have?
Oh, yeah, no, it is. I mean, that's one of the things, this sort of ties into the Ferguson case out in Missouri. One of the things that people don't realize in Vermont, and actually the country generally, is how difficult it is to get basic statistical information about what police are doing. The Washington Post had an editorial last week that pointed out that nobody knows how many times per year U.S. police officers use deadly force and how many people die as a result. The Post was trying to get that number because of what happened in Ferguson, and it found out that actually that number doesn't exist. In Vermont, all sorts of numbers don't exist about law enforcement. Three times this year, people have asked, well, how many police departments do we have in this state of Vermont? And people have not been able to answer because we don't have a centralized system. It's a very loose, locally controlled system of sheriff's departments and local PDs and the state police, and then their law enforcement officers within liquor control and their fish and wildlife wardens who have police authorization. But there's no one place where all that is overseen. The only place is the Criminal Justice Training Council, which makes sure that officers who are working are certified. But beyond that, a lot of stuff we don't know. One of them has been we don't know how many tasers are out there. We don't know how many times they've been deployed. We don't know the full extent of the injuries. with these reports, which will start as of January 1st, 2015, we should start getting that information.
Might be something we don't want to know, actually, depending on what those numbers are.
Well, one thing that we did this past year when the bill was going through the legislature was we tried to find out how many settlements there have been in lawsuits involving tasers. And we did, you know, we did a whole bunch of searches, and we called people up, and we went to newspaper files. And what we found was that since 2004, a total of $287,500 has been paid out in eight different lawsuits alleging taser abuse by Vermont police. And that really shocked me because I didn't think, A, there were that many cases, and B, that there were that many cases that resulted in more than $250,000 in payouts to victims, alleged victims. Almost all the cases, in fact, I think all of the cases didn't go to trial. They settled out of court, which is the usual way that complaints against the police are adjudicated. But that's a lot of money. I mean, that's public money eventually. You know, it's insurance payments, but that all comes from public money. And that's why we think it's really important, besides protecting people's lives, that tasers are used in a way that's more responsible than they've been used in the past.
So what do you think the biggest challenge is as we go forward? We get the statewide policy, we have the annual reporting, hopefully police officer actually getting trained in de-escalation tactics. What do you think the biggest challenge is going to be?
Well, I think first getting all those things in place and then making sure they happen on a regular basis, the data gets collected, somebody is analyzing it, putting it in a form that we can learn from what the numbers are telling us. I think specifically one of the biggest challenges, Robert was talking about this a bit before, and Rhonda Taylor sort of alluded to it, is when police deal with people who are having a mental health problem or they have a physical disability that may make it hard for them simply to understand what police are saying, let alone what they're about to do with a taser. We know that some people are adversely affected because of a medical condition when they receive 50,000 volts of electricity. I think the next big challenge is to look at how the tasers are being used specifically on certain populations to figure out if they're being used as responsibly and appropriately as possible. We, the ACLU, has argued that police should not use tasers unless deadly force is justified. We were not successful in getting that as the standard. And I think because there is still quite a bit of leeway for the use of tasers, watching how tasers are used is going to be very, very important.
So is there anything during the legislative session besides the reports coming back? Will there be a new bill this year, or is it more just making sure everything is happening on the schedule that it was meant to happen?
I think on tasers, at least, it's watching to make sure that things will happen when they're supposed to. One of the things that's in the new law, which we think is a good idea, is a provision that if a department does not, by the end of 2016, adopt a policy at least as stringent as the policy coming out from the Vermont Criminal Justice Training Council, if policy is not adopted, it will be assumed that the department has adopted the official Vermont Criminal Justice Training Council policy. So it's going to be impossible after the end of next year for a department not to have a policy in place concerning taser use, and we think that's good.
Great. Well, Alan, thank you so much for doing that work, Alan Gilbert and the ACLU of Vermont, and thank you for joining us today and talking to us about this important bill.
Thanks for having me on the show.
And listeners, again, if you want to check out the ACLU, it's acluvt.org. I'd like to thank you all for joining today and listening. Thank you to our guests, Randy Lazotte and Max Barrows from the Green Mountain Self-Advocates, Rhonda Taylor, Robert Appel, Alan Gilbert. Congratulations to Anthony Polina on winning the GMSA Ally of the Year. Remember to vote today or tomorrow, and next week it's Labor Day, so thank a union and listen in for some baseball on WDEV.
locally owned and operated, 96.1 WDEV, FM in Warren, FM 96.5 in Barrie, and AM 550 WDEV. Waterbury, Montpelier, serving the kingdom on FM 101.9 from Island Pond. 2 o'clock, World and National News Update on the stations of Radio Vermont.
AP Radio News.